This is a podcast from policyreview.tv.
Hi, I'm going to go over a number of items with you today. It will require me to be able to synchronise with Tom, who's sitting back in the back there somewhere, because I cannot see what is actually on the screen in front of you. So I just hope that I can get a degree of synchronization in place. And I hope that now that you've got the second slide, which shows what I'm going to go over this morning, or this afternoon indeed. Is that so?
Yep, it's there.
Excellent, thanks. So we're firing away. Now, the next slide is to bring us in touch with a difficult definitional problem, which is around our understanding of what we mean by private. As I haven't been with you this morning, I don't know the level, the amount to which you've covered this, but I've just heard you referring to the profit and not-for-profit providers. But that varies a lot according to country, because even within the US, the not-for-profit independent or private sector includes organizations like Harvard, Stanford, Yale, Georgetown, etc., as well as the for-profits. Also, that is often referred to in terms of the public investment in a private. For example, in India, there is significant public investment from government into a number of private or independent institutions, most of which are not for profit. And as I think most of you know, a large proportion of the funding in the US of even the for-profit private institutions comes through the grants given to students, the loans, and in some cases the Pell grants, given to students to cover the costs of running the private institutions. And then, of course, you've got the faith-based groups and the other foundations. In Indonesia, the leading universities are, in fact, probably the number one is a faith-based Catholic university, but there are also Islamic universities around Indonesia. And we're almost left with the final definition that a private institution is anything that isn't public or isn't defined as public. And then we run into the same definitional problems of public-private, and then what we might mean by partnership. And to be honest, because there is so much overlap in everything, I have not bothered to define it here, because I've got various matrices, but they're so complex, in the end, I decided it doesn't clarify our thinking. So what does it matter as long as it works? Now, going to the next slide, where we're looking at what I would describe when we're working internationally in terms of three broad sorts of partnership. One in which the institution that's awarding the degree has an in-country presence, i.e. a campus or some form of support center in some country. The second is where we contracting out the provision and delivering in some form of partnership or contractee-contractor relationship through an institution in the country, through a validation arrangement, which or else franchising, licensing, twinning. Bit of a definitional problem there on what we might mean by twinning, but frequently it's most referred to in terms of articulation, where you're doing part of the program in the country and part back on the home campus. And then, of course, there's all the forms of distance learning, online, fully online delivery, and all the different formats. But also, it's any mix of all the above. That's what we increasingly see. And, of course, the famous flying faculty that get everywhere. So trying to give a typology here is seriously difficult. And if we turn to some work that I've been doing courtesy of the UK India Education and Research Initiative. I hope you see in front of you the list of a survey of foreign partnerships in India, where you can see the dominance of the UK in the 640 programs that we looked at as part of this program. And if you actually then look at how those programs were delivered, in the middle there, you see that the largest single number, 216, had some form of twinning or articulation arrangement. And this leads to the first finding on many of these partnerships, is that actually a very large number of students enrolled on them ultimately come back to the home campus for part of their program. And that same thing has been found in Australia. And turning to the next slide, which shows the various modes of delivery, where on this, in India, we see that the largest number of the programs are full-time, and actually they're delivered face-to-face, 569 of the 630-odd. They are, of course, some of them then supported with by flying tutor. So that's the pattern we see in India, and you're beginning to see that in a number of other countries. I'm moving on now to one of the big areas of growth in the world, for particularly for in-country presence, has been Dubai, Qatar, and the Emirates. These are a selection of universities that are based there. So we see ones from India, several from the UK, from the US, and from Australia, all operating there. And on the next slide, it shows even more, where we note it's not just the teaching-oriented institutions, it's a lot of very significant research-led institutions that are developing a presence. And when we let's start bringing us closer to home, where we see what I think is probably one of the best campuses of a private university in existence. This is Holt's new campus in London. And then on the next one, we see an arrangement, Thompson Rivers in India, where they have a study centre. That's the study centre port. And then the next one, we see Manipal, an Indian institution that is now delivering its own programmes in various partnerships in Malaysia. So it's not just dominated by Australia, US, and the UK. We're seeing a wide number. Similarly, we see Lancaster in India. And then some of the more well-known ones that we have, our own Nottingham University from UK in a private partnership with a Malaysian investment company, as well as a similar or a related arrangement in China in Ningbo. And then I couldn't resist this because I think is Drummond there today? I hope I'm still on the laureate slide. Yes, okay. And that is quite an amazing, that's beginning to get quite a complex mix of partnerships. And then similarly, if we move on to what I think is one of the most broadest base range of partnerships, which is the German cooperation in Egypt that seems to involve about 10 different organizations to deliver one set of programs in the German University of Cairo. Moving on, we see here Kaplan, it's the first of the relationships of Kaplan, where they are delivering through their now owned Asia Pacific Management Institute in partnership with a number of universities from the US, from Australia, from the UK and Ireland. And indeed, if you move, the next one shows Kaplan moving into Australia. I don't know if you've covered all these this afternoon in the conference so far, but we're beginning to see these big trends in growth around the world. Now, the difficulty is that not everything succeeds. And in fact, there has been quite a bit of bad press building up. You know about University of New South Wales, Singapore. Now we're running into problems with Monash in Johannesburg. This is very recent. This last month, this has happened. I can go into a bit detail, but I don't have time now. We see the problems of Michigan State now closing down in Dubai, Carnegie Mellon in Adelaide having serious questions, and so it goes on. So we begin to run into problems, and it tars all of us with the same accusation that we haven't got control and we might be losing our positions. This is high profile in the US. Tom Harkin asking serious questions about the role of the private providers in the US, and similarly, taken up by Obama. There's quite a bit of debate in the US press, including some fairly powerful defensive statements about the for-profit universities. But of course, as I would say, on a cold day like this, if all else fails, I think you need to take the view from Stendon University in from the Netherlands, that has this lovely campus that it's developed in Bali. It's the only one that I know of, I'm sure, although some of you might know more about these things. Galloping through, I can't skip slides easily, but I'm going to move now into the UK and look specifically at some institutions that with whom I'm working. The next slide just gives us an overview of who is operating in London. Is that the slide you've got at the moment? Or have you got a table?
Got a table.
Ah, excellent. Okay. Well, the table is telling you from HESA data how many programs from UK higher education institutions are being delivered globally. If you look along the top grand total line, through some form of collaborative delivery, something like almost two-thirds of the programs, or sorry, of the students enrolled are involved in these areas. It's a very, very large number. And again, we've still got Malaysia as the largest provider. Obviously, there's a health warning over these statistics because HESA have only started working hard at trying to collect them recently. But the numbers are very large, they're growing, and dominated with different forms of collaborative provision as far as the UK is concerned. Now, moving on quickly, just to say about the UK independent sector, I was just listening to the last two sessions. I think you've covered that about the concentration and what they're doing. I would also stress that for the independent sector, there's three major imperatives. First of all, the fees are our only revenue source. So we've got to deliver something that the clients, either students, require. Quality is central. As you've just been hearing, if we don't get our quality right, we will not meet the regulatory body's requirements, and therefore we will then cease to attract students. And also, quality is imperative because without it, we will not get that tier four a status for immigration on which our students depend. We depend to recruit students. So all of these are extremely important for us, and they're the three driving imperatives. Just to show some of the institutions in London, it's getting a very crowded and interesting picture. On the right, you can see Tasmac, which is an Indian private provider with a campus in London, accredited by the University of Wales. Underneath them, the London School of Business and Finance runs a number of degrees, including an amber accredited by the Grands Écoles in Geneva. So we're in continuous change these days. But now, for the last 5 minutes, I'm just going to quickly go through the operation of the London School of Commerce. These are our programs. We do have about 5,000 students. They do come from over 130 countries, and we have about 3,000 on our MBA programs. It's difficult for us to count them in the way the public sector institutions do, because we have 6 intakes per annum. So there is not a straightforward. I'm just going to refer now to the UWIC relationship, where you can see UWIC is our main validating university. We've got 2 live campuses at the moment, in addition to the main one in London, in KL and Dhaka. We are this year going through the process of opening 3 new campuses in Nairobi, Colombo, and Belgrade, and they are currently being validated. The institution that we are, our bricks and mortar, is on the top left there. It's in near London Bridge. The next one will show our operation in Kuala Lumpur, the Westminster College, the next one in Dhaka. And then I have a number of shots of our students and staff working, high IT usage, just to keep all our library facilities are online. And as you'll see in a minute, we go straight to the UWIC backup. Are we on the cultural side yet? Do we have cricketers or dancers?
Dancers.
Okay, great. I know where I am now. And then, of course, we've got the cricketers. And as it's with rugby, we have the rugby players. And there you can see our graduation ceremony in our hall, which happens to be Southwark Cathedral on a Sunday. So we have a big operation here, and the numbers require constant quality assurance, because we cannot slip up, or else our good name will go. This is diagrammatically why I think the relationship works well. Primarily, it's that relationship between the 2 chief executives, the vice chancellor and our CEO in the London School of Commerce. They are on the same wavelength. They want to make it work. But all our staff trust each other. But it can't be just on trust. You have to have formal relationships. And as I show in the next slide, this requires much effort through the exam boards. We have a special advisor in UWIC who visits regularly. We have regular visits and contact with Dhaka and KL. We have UWIC staff on the premises almost every day. We've even recruited a number of them to be permanently based with us, that we have supervisory support. We've got 50 external supervisors for dissertations. Almost every business school in London shares supervisors with us. And we, as I mentioned, have a high use of online systems. So there's both formal and informal contact that keeps us in touch with our validating institution, UWIC. As I said, it's close and shared. It's about confidence. But UWIC have had to gain confidence that our own internal systems are robust and are not going to undermine their QAA recognition. And this is how they do it. I hope you see the UWIC quality police as they enter our Dhaka campus to just check that we're doing everything right. And then turning to the next one, Competition or mutual benefit? These are what we believe UWIC benefits from. And similarly, we have a mix of benefits in LSC, which clearly shows why we like the relationship with UWIC and obviously also with Gloucester and with University of East London. But the next one also is the most important because we believe the students benefit. We, because of the high level of intensity of our programs, we don't allow absenteeism. We've got a very high pass rate on these UWIC programs. We believe we're highly competitive priced. We believe we work very well through knowing our students. We have our own staff in every country who are in touch with the students and their family. I'm not going to show you the next slide because I can see I'm rapidly running out of time and it's your lunchtime. But what I would like to leave you with are these few questions. Is there a shelf life for collaborative delivery? Will it go when other overseas countries have got their own systems up and running? How should HEFCE treat us? Thirdly, why don't we have any large UK HE enterprises like Laureate or like Kaplan or all the other big US providers? We have a powerful international brand from the UK. We also are the center of global finance. And it always amazes me why we haven't somehow got that together. You know the fourth point. What has to be worrying is the increasing dominance of the US private providers globally. And will we just see more and more of them coming into UK trying to purchase UK institutions? And I leave you with that thought. And thank you very much.